Welcome to a new episode of our Goethe podcast about the power of propaganda. This time we are going to explore propaganda strategies in Nazi Germany. Many of the strategies used in the 1930s and 40s might seem strikingly familiar when compared to modern populist approaches. So today you may actually learn a lot about both history and politics.
Yes, absolutely. Livia, Clara, Catherine, Anna and I will walk you through a really dark chapter in history and show you how easy it is to manipulate people like you and me. We will also deal with rhetoric and logic to show how Nazi propaganda minister Josef Goebbels managed to excite the masses. Clara is first tonight to tell us about the nature of Nazi propaganda. Clara, can you explain to our listeners what Nazi propaganda was all about?
Oh, there's of course a lot one might think of, but the main topics in Nazi propaganda were probably nationalism, racism, and anti-Semitism. Hate messages were repeated again and again until they finally sank in.
Sounds pretty negative.
Well, in Nazi Germany, propaganda was effectively used by politicians to maintain power and win the support of millions of Germans. This was bad news for those minorities which became the target of an inhuman propaganda that facilitated discrimination, persecution, and ultimately genocide. And let us not forget that it helped to start another world war. So it's no wonder that propaganda was an important activity for the NSDAP, the political party which we also know as Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei. Through propaganda, the Nazis spread their ideology in a way which was always addressed to the broad masses. And this was the reason why it was generally presented in a popular form.
How exactly was propaganda spread at that time?
During the Nazi era, people in Germany were in fact constantly confronted with propaganda. Books, newspapers and magazines, as well as new media such as radio, cinema and TV were important means of disseminating Nazi views. There was, for example, a daily newspaper called Der Völkischer Beobachter, which was published from February 1925 onwards to spread the ideas of the party. Another propagandistic paper was Der Stürmer, which discriminated Jews and its articles and posters. Neues Volk was a monthly publication by the Office of Racial Policy, which answered questions about so-called race relations. It also contained articles about the alleged superiority of Aryans.
Oh yes, this crappy concept of a so-called master race was at the heart of Nazi propaganda.
Indeed, but not all propaganda was racist. There were, for example, magazines that aimed at women and dealt with the role of women in the Nazi state. Women were urged to have children even in wartime and to put forth the ideas of the Nazis.
And what about the other media you mentioned?
One of the primary sources for propaganda was the Wehrmachtsbericht, a daily radio broadcast that spread Hitler's speeches all over Germany. Over time, even restaurants and pubs were expected to have their radios on when Hitler was delivering a speech. Another central component of Nazi propaganda was the film industry. The Nazis produced many films to promote their views and ideology. In addition, propaganda was used during public gatherings. The Nazi party relied heavily on speakers to present its propaganda in front of thousands of people. Specific groups were targeted in this way, especially the Hitler Youth. The use of drums and fire torches was supposed to make the audience feel that they were part of a new, exciting movement.
What impact do you think did Nazi propaganda have on young people?
The Nazis succeeded in influencing the values and beliefs of many young Germans. This goes for organizations like the Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls, but especially schools use propaganda for indoctrination. Textbooks and posters, for example, were used to teach the German youth what was back then called racial awareness. Even the school curricula were changed to remind the young generation of what the Nazis considered to be their racial duties to the national community.
Thanks, Clara, for explaining about the mechanism of this propaganda apparatus. I think this has made it a lot easier to understand why people fell for Nazi propaganda in the first place. Eric, I guess it's your turn now to give us an overview of the history of Nazi Germany.
Yes, and I will do so together with Catherine. Okay then, Why don't we go back to the year 1923?
The time of the Weimar Republic, a democratic system established just after the First World War.
Yes, but also a point in time which shows what made it possible for an authoritarian state to emerge. We all know that the political and parliamentary system during the Weimar Republic was unstable, which led to great frustration. But the economic situation was maybe even worse. In 1923, there was a major economic crisis which caused a hyperinflation. At one point, $1 was worth 4.2 trillion Reichsmark. Isn't that crazy?
Shocking.
This hyperinflation caused panic among the population. This made it possible for populist and extremist parties to become more powerful. This made it possible for extremist parties to become more powerful. This made it possible for populist and extremist parties to become more powerful. Although Germany was able to overcome the crisis, its economy still heavily depended on the United States. During the Great Depression in 1929, unemployment rates were incredibly high. Many who had once had a safe job were now out on the streets.
You mean the situation paved the way for extremists, as many people did not trust the parliament to be able to deal with the increasing problems?
Absolutely. This frustration showed in the election results of 1930. The Nazi Party gained nearly 20% of the votes in this year.
So it was a democratic vote that put Hitler into power?
Not exactly. During that time, political decisions were often made only by a few people, in presidential cabinets. After Hindenburg had appointed two new chancellors, who both failed, von Papen, one of the two previous chancellors, suggested that Hitler should be appointed as the new chancellor. He believed that Hitler and his party could be controlled.
Bad mistake.
Yes, but at that time Hitler presented himself as the savior of the German people in a time of trouble. When the Reichstag was put on fire in 1933, the Nazis claimed that communists were responsible for the attack. Hitler used this event to persuade Hindenburg to issue an emergency decree that temporarily suspended basic rights. Hitler then introduced the Enabling Act, another important step towards dictatorship.
Yes, the power of the Nazis was immense. Just think of what happened 2 years later, in 1935. On the 16th of March, Hitler announced the German rearmament in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. On the 15th of September, the racist Nuremberg laws went into effect. And on that very day, the swastika flag was made the German national flag on Hitler's orders. After that, the Nazi Party seemed unstoppable. There was the remilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936, the annexation of Austria 1938, the occupation of the Sudetenland, and finally the offensive against Poland, which ignited World War II in 1939.
Was there really no one to stop Hitler?
Well, it was harder than one might think. In 1938, Hitler had abolished the war ministry and created the High Command of Armed Forces. By doing so, he gave himself direct control of the German military and was able to get rid of political and military leaders considered unsympathetic to his ideology. I think Stalingrad was a turning point. After this battle, many people doubted that the war could be won, despite all the propaganda. But it was not before the 8th of May 1945 that the Third Reich ended, after 12 years.
And 6 years of war, which cost millions of lives.
Yes, and one should not forget that Joseph Goebbels and his propaganda ministry played a major role in making the people believe that they fought a just war. Only think of the Sports Palace speech in 1943, in which he called for a total war.
Actually, Anna and I would like to use this speech as an example of how people may be manipulated through rhetoric and false logic.
Yes, I think that we heard earlier about the new media is really important. I would say that one piece of new technology, the radio, was really crucial for the success of the Nazi propaganda. Goebbels himself has supported the production and distribution of a cheap radio, the so-called People's Receiver, so that everyone could hear the messages of the Führer.
Anna, can you tell us more about Goebbels and his goals?
Generally, one can say that Goebbels had three main goals. First, he wanted to hide the truth For example, about Germany not being as successful in war as the people should think. He also wanted to arouse hatred and suppress rational arguments. His third goal was to corrupt the people so that they would not object to his cruel politics and ideology.
True, after all, the actions of Goebbels and the NSDAP led to the murder of over 6 million Jews and a war which turned out to be the worst in the history of mankind.
Yes, and even though people suffered from the war, both in the trenches and at the home front, Goebbels still tried to stir their enthusiasm. This is why he used many rhetorical devices, and also the structure of his speech is well thought out. At the beginning, for example, there is an appeal to patriotism and loyalty.
Quote, "What an example German soldiers have set in this great age, and what an obligation it puts on us all, particularly the entire German homeland."
The speech becomes increasingly emotional, and the crowd gets so excited so that the listeners answer in the affirmative even when Goebbels speaks of the worst kind of war imaginable.
Quote, "I ask you, do you want total war? If necessary, do you want a war more total and radical than anything that we can even imagine today?"
As you can infer from their reaction, listeners allowed themselves to be led by their emotions only. And why? Because Goebbels gave them the impression that they could trust him, that he had told them the truth, and that there was only one conclusion to be drawn from this.
Quote, We face a serious military challenge in the East. There is no point in disputing the seriousness of the situation. I do not want to give you a false impression of the situation that could lead to false conclusions, perhaps giving the German people a false sense of security that is altogether inappropriate in the present situation.
He uses inclusive language when he says that we face a challenge. This is to encourage a sense of shared identity. The people feel acknowledged and taken seriously. Goebbels pretends that he understands the German people and that he does not hold back information but shares everything with them. Goebbels also makes use of the populist idea of the general will of the people, or volonté générale. For populists, the general will of the people is something that should take precedence. This is at least what they would like us to believe. In Nazi Germany, the ordinary people did not actually have a say. Decisions were not made with them, but for them.
So it was all about creating the feeling that they were in the same boat?
Yes, or more precisely, the feeling said it was us against them. This is why Goebbels conjures up the image of a Jewish Bolshevist conspiracy.
Quote, "The goal of Bolshevism is Jewish world revolution. They want to bring chaos to the Reich and Europe."
In addition, he uses neologisms like Weltpest, in English a worldwide plague. He clearly identifies the Jews as a danger that needs to be fought. The new word suggests that Jews are non-human, and it ensures that the ideology sticks in people's minds, which was of course Goebbels' intention.
Terrible, all this hatred.
And that from a man who had initially said,
quote, "I would therefore speak with holy seriousness and openness."
The connotation of holy is of course religious, and for most people in those days that was very positive. In reality, we see here a very unholy exploitation of emotion.
This brings us to our last topic. What if we look at reason instead of emotion? That is, at the logical fallacies in Goebbels' speech.
Could you explain what logical fallacies are, Livia?
Sure. Logical fallacies are errors in reasoning that lead to wrong conclusions and statements that only seem to be logical. There's a long list of different logical fallacies that can be found in political speeches or essays.
Can you give an example?
Of course. Think, for example, of hasty generalizations, which are based on insufficient evidence. When Goebbels talks about his audience, he calls them a cross-section of the entire German people. We should not jump to conclusions, however, because there is no evidence that the listeners in the Berlin Sports Palace were a representative selection of German citizens. The audience was in fact carefully chosen, so that only Nazi supporters were present. Another logical fallacy is the false dilemma. It is about giving two really extreme alternatives and ignoring anything in between. It is just either or. Other options do not seem to exist.
Quote, I ask you, are you resolved to follow the Führer through thick and thin to victory? And are you willing to accept the heaviest personal burdens?
Ah, I see. This question suggests that there's only one way, to follow Hitler and win the war, or not to follow his lead and lose.
And since no one in his right mind would want to lose a war, it is a purely rhetorical question with an obvious answer.
Exactly. There would have been other options, like peace negotiations. But Goebbels wants his listener to believe in Hitler. End of story.
Interesting. Are there more logical errors in the speech?
Oh yes. For example, the false analogy. Goebbels tells his listeners to make sacrifices in order to win the war.
Quote, "The individual may have to make great sacrifices, but they are tiny when compared to the sacrifices he would have to make if his refusal brought down on us the greatest national disaster. It is better to operate at the right time than to wait until the disease has taken root. One may not complain to the doctor or sue him for bodily injury. He cuts not to kill, but to save the patient's life."
Sending young men to the front and asking women to work long hours in the war industry, thus sacrificing their time, their health, probably even their life, all this is compared to a doctor trying to heal a patient.
What? He compares people's sacrifices in the military conflict to medical treatment? This doesn't make any sense at all.
But Goebbels' listeners did not have the time to think it through. For them, the message was clear. What you are doing now may feel bad, but it's necessary, and in the long run, it will be for your own good. So logical fallacies try to make us believe that something is plausible, though the logic behind is
rubbish.
Yes, let me give you one last example. The common sense fallacy. It means that arguments are presented as being so obvious that even a child could get it. It also implies that one does not need to ask whether something is really true, because it's a matter of course. Let's look at this odious quote about the Jews that Anna mentioned earlier.
Quote, "Our courageous and just battle against this worldwide plague will not be hindered by the worldwide outcry of international Jewry. It can and must end only with victory."
The logic here is non-existent. Even if we assume that someone fights bravely and for a just cause, it does not automatically follow that he will win. I hope this helped you to understand how Nazi propaganda worked.
Yes, I think we have seen that some of the propaganda strategies, the use of new media, rhetorical devices, false logic and hate messages are very similar to what we see today.
But the difference is that we have a chance to learn from the past.
And that we have a strong democracy.
And the European Union as a peacekeeper.
We hope you liked our podcast. Stay critical and remember, it is for all of us to make this world a better place.